The Constitution of the United States is many things to many different people. Some people consider it, quite appropriately, the fundamental law of our land. Other people consider it more in religious terms, almost as holy writ. And still others think of it as an outdated and outmoded relic of the past. Whatever your perspective, whatever your characterization, I have to remind you that among all the things the Constitution is, it's a bunch of paper with words on it. And guess what? Someone had to write those words. Someone had to actually put them down. Who did that stuff? Who were those guys? Well, today we've got Rick Beeman of the University of Pennsylvania and author of Plain Honest Men, who's going to tell us who wrote that document. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and we're going to talk about who wrote the Constitution.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Regular listeners to this show will know that I attended law school at the University of Pennsylvania. I actually graduated there. I actually made it all the way through. And there are many, many wonderful things about Penn. One of those is that it's located in the city of brotherly love, the cradle of our constitutional democracy, the city of Philadelphia. And in the city of Philadelphia, of course, is Independence Hall and the National Constitution Center and all kinds of other cool things. One thing, however, that I overlooked when I was in law school, I shouldn't have, and that is, who were those guys who wrote the United States Constitution? I mean, I knew they were there. I knew they were in Independence Hall. But who were they, and who was most responsible for that foundational document of American law? Who were these people? Uh-oh, I've given something away. There was more than one person. And to tell us about those people, those men who wrote our Constitution, is a marvelous fellow from the University of Pennsylvania. His name is Rick Beeman, and he wrote a perfectly wonderful book that I will commend to each and every one of you. It's called Plain Honest Men. Well, Dr. Rick Beeman, thank you for being with us today.
It's my great pleasure.
It's our pleasure as well. So, sir, here is the question. Who wrote our Constitution?
Well, there's a short answer and a long answer, but I'll start with a medium-sized answer. It's not often that much good in the way of a literary excellence comes out of a committee. But the men in the Constitutional Convention comprised a committee of the whole. And in the most important senses, the Constitution was a joint effort among a group of disparate men from different regions of the country, with different interests, different political philosophies. Yet they managed to get that particular writing project done. So that's my medium-sized answer. But I'm certainly happy to talk about some of those men who made the most significant contributions.
Well, please do. I've often heard it said, somewhat dismissively, that these were just 55 white guys. But I guess there's a little bit more diversity and a little bit more detail than that.
Right. And the title of my recent book on the Constitutional Convention is Plain Honest Men: The Making of the American Constitution. And that phrase, plain honest men, was used by one of the delegates, Gouverneur Morris of Pennsylvania. And he used that phrase in order to disabuse any one of the notion that God had a hand in writing the Constitution.
Okay.
He was quite adamant that, you know, these were not divinely inspired men, that these were ordinary men who sat down and got the job done. In fact, they weren't altogether plain, honest men. They were mostly, overwhelmingly wealthy white men. But that suggests that they all were just alike and that they all thought alike.
I've heard that term used. People try to, you know, try to suggest that this was just a bunch of privileged people who excluded women, who excluded minorities. And I think they try to paint them as sort of monolithic. But I'm hearing something different from you.
Yeah, well, in the context of the 21st century, They may look all pretty similar to us. But in the context of the very provincial world of the 18th century, these men, who were mostly men of privilege, they wouldn't have been elected by their legislatures as delegates to the Congress if they hadn't been considered prominent political leaders in their home colonies. But they did display among them, by the standards of their time, remarkably different regional interests, economic interests, different religious backgrounds. Certainly, they all considered themselves in one way or another to be Christians. But again, in the context of the 18th century, they represented a wide variety of Protestant religious faiths. There were two Catholics in the group. So I think that when you look closely at these men, they weren't just a bunch of wealthy white men.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It makes it so much more interesting to talk about them. Okay, now I'll accept your invitation. Who were the most important fellows in this process, and then could you tell us a bit about them, please?
Okay, well, we've got to start with this short, sickly, hypochondriacal 37-year-old bachelor with a notable record of failure in any kind of romantic venture up to that time, James Madison. James Madison, more than any man in the convention, had spent the previous few years worrying about the state of the Continental Government under the Articles of Confederation. He'd served in the Continental Congress, which went for months at a time without even being able to do any business because they couldn't assemble a quorum. And in the spring of 1787, the early spring, he sat down and wrote a lengthy treatise on the vices of the political systems of the United States, which was his catalog of all of the weaknesses in both the individual state governments and in the Confederation government. Madison was instrumental in persuading George Washington, who truly did not want to leave his retirement in Mount Vernon, to come and spend a summer in Philadelphia. He persuaded Washington to come to the convention. Madison arrived in Philadelphia on May 3rd, 11 days before the convention was due to begin, 22 days before the convention actually began.
That was extremely important, wasn't it?
He arrived at least with the bare outlines of a plan for a new government.
Yeah, now that's really, really important, because I think anybody who is an experienced politico knows that getting early to a meeting and setting the agenda for a meeting is one of the most effective ways to control the outcome of a meeting. And despite his shortness and despite his reticence and his quiet voice, Madison was well known as a very good behind-the-scenes political operator, wasn't he?
That's right, and he would continue in that role really for much of his life. He was instrumental in the organization of during the 1790s of what we call the Jeffersonian Republican Party, but it was as much Madison's work as Jefferson's. But in any case, yes, Madison arrived in town early. By the way, the only other delegate outside of Pennsylvania to arrive at the convention by its appointed starting time, which was May 14th, was Madison's Virginia colleague, George Washington. When they took the walk to the Pennsylvania State House on May 14th to begin the convention, they were appalled to discover that the only delegates who showed up on time were the Pennsylvania delegates, and that was easy for them because they all lived in Philadelphia.
That is just remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I often say to audiences to whom I talk about this subject, I say, if you had been elected to serve as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention of 1787, when you think about the extraordinary accomplishment of that body, don't you think you would have taken the trouble to show up on time? But in fact, Nobody other than Madison and Washington took that trouble. And the moral of that story, it seems to me, is that few people at the time realized how important this gathering would be. Few at the time had much confidence that the gathering would be as successful as it was, and that the document that they would produce would be as long-lasting and as far-reaching. So it really is helpful, I think, to remind ourselves that what seems to us as not only an important outcome, but somehow a kind of inevitable outcome, was anything but in May of 1787.
Oh, you're exactly right, and I think that's one of the important things that I learned from your book is the dismissiveness with which some people at the time treated this entire convention. Rhode Island, of course, wouldn't even show up, but other states were very late, yeah. And they didn't.
Rhode Island never showed up. The two delegates from New Hampshire didn't show up until July 23rd, and the only reason they finally showed up was that one of the two delegates agreed to pay for the expenses of both of the delegates.
Good grief.
Because New Hampshire's legislature, which has always been known for its frugality, was sufficiently frugal that they refused to pay the delegates they elected any expense money.
Just remarkable.
And Maryland's delegates kind of, you know, floated in and out. And interestingly, New York's two of the three New York delegates were almost never there, leaving Alexander Hamilton the sole representative of New York, but not actually entitled to vote because New York didn't have a quorum for much of the convention.
Just remarkable. But okay, so George Washington and James Madison, they show up at the hall. There's almost nobody there, but this actually worked out to Madison's advantage. How did he use that
time?
That's
right, but something very, and by the way, Washington, when he discovers that no one's shown up, is really annoyed because he didn't want to come. Truly, I mean, Washington, everybody told Washington, everyone who tried to persuade him to come, said your presence is essential if this convention is to be a success. And he knew that to be the case, but he had no confidence that his mere presence would be enough to guarantee the convention's success. So when he discovers that nobody showed up on time, he's really wondering whether this has all been in vain. He's put his reputation on the line, and no good may come of it. But, as you say, some good did come of it. What happened next was that Madison, and by the way, most of the other Virginia delegates did trickle into town soon thereafter. So Madison, Washington, George Mason of Virginia, Edmund Randolph of Virginia, they began to meet from May 14th through May 25th with the delegates from Pennsylvania, many of whom did not know one another, but they came to know one another, and they came to discover that they were of like mind, that they really did want not just a mere tinkering with the old Articles of Confederation, but a scrapping of the Articles of Confederation altogether and the creation of a strong, and I underscore this word, a strong national government. In the words of Gouverneur Morris, with a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. So it was that group of Virginia and Pennsylvania delegates who, by the way, really got their start around the dining room table in the home of Benjamin Franklin on the evening of May 16th, where he lubricated the congeniality of the evening with a cask of porter that he had just imported from England.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's another thing that I was reminded of when I was reading your book, was how important hospitality was to lubricating, and not just the alcohol, but you know, that was part of it, but lubricating this entire convention, because you've got all these very strong-willed men, and they've got to get along in order to be able to compromise.
That's exactly right. And so whatever differences of opinion, and they did have differences of opinion, they may have expressed on the convention floor during the day, by evening, they all lived close together in these small boarding houses clustered around what we today call Independence Mall in Philadelphia. They dined together, they drank together, they literally slept together in these same boarding houses. The Connecticut delegates actually had to share the same room in their boarding house. And so they really did get to know one another. There was a time, I'm old enough to remember this time, in Washington, D.C., when our Congress men and women, then mostly men, would have the same experience. They would spend the congressional session living in Washington, D.C. 7 days a week. And, for example, after Senate Majority Leader and Senate Minority Leader Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen had a tough day on the floor of the Senate, they'd go out to dinner and have a few martinis and find a way to reach common ground. And so these delegates were doing the same thing. And the real beginning of that occurred around Benjamin Franklin's dining room table on the night of May 16th, when this group of Virginia and Pennsylvania delegates began to formulate what would become known as the Virginia Plan.
And the Virginia,
and that is Madison's principal claim to authorship of the Constitution, or to being the father of the Constitution, that although Madison did not write the Virginia Plan all by himself, he was the guiding spirit behind it.
And the key there to the Virginia Plan, though there were obviously lots of different facets to it, was what you just said a moment ago, and that it was a national plan. It was actually seeking to move sovereignty from these 13 disparate independent states that were loosely confederated into this new national government that was going to be created. It was really a fundamental shift in where the power lay.
That is exactly right. And although the finished product voted on September 17th, nearly 4 months later, did not look all that similar to the Virginia Plan. By that time, the delegates were calling their government a federal government rather than a national government. But it nevertheless had these strong nationalistic elements in it. And that, by the way, the Virginia Plan and the decision to move forward with a discussion which centered on the merits of the Virginia Plan was itself a kind of violation of the instructions given to the delegates by the Continental Congress, which told them that they were being elected to come to Philadelphia to discuss amendments to the Articles of Confederation. But pretty much from day one, nobody ever talked about the Articles of Confederation.
And that's so remarkably important. And that was really Madison's genius, was that he not only came up with many of these ideas, but by getting his plan before the convention and setting the agenda from the very beginning, he was actually able, with remarkable efficacy, to keep things pretty much on his terms throughout most of that summer.
I think that's right, that they really did, in effect, steal the initiative from any opponents who might have been present. I will say another thing about this: the composition of this body, although there were many differences of opinion, strong differences of opinion between large state delegates and small state delegates, northern delegates and southern slave state delegates. By and large, the group of men who chose, after they were elected by their legislatures, to actually show up and take part in these discussions all summer, were men inclined to believe that something pretty dramatic needed to be done to strengthen the Continental government. And it's notable, we'll talk more about some of the men who were present in Philadelphia that summer, but think about the men who weren't there that summer. Patrick Henry of Virginia, one of the foremost advocates of state sovereignty. Patrick Henry was busy with the politics of Virginia. He got more votes from the Virginia legislature to serve as delegate to the convention than anyone other than George Washington. But he declined to attend because he thought the business at home was more important. Sam Adams and John Hancock of Massachusetts thought there were more important things to do back in Massachusetts. Governor George Clinton of New York, a strong defender of state sovereignty in New York.
You know, that's a remarkable observation, because it seems then that the greatest opponents of the Constitution, and they would eventually be called the anti-federalists during the ratification debates, they made a terrible strategic error, and that is they stayed home.
That is exactly right. And of course, their strategic error was compounded by the fact that one of the first things that the delegates did, an act which would seem shocking to us today, but we should thank the Lord that they did it, and I'm happy to elaborate on that opinion in a minute. They chose to meet all that summer entirely in secret. So not only were Patrick Henry and Sam Adams and George Clinton not there, they didn't know what was going on, because barely a word of the proceedings leaked out over the course of the summer. I've said, indeed, I've written, if Patrick Henry had known of the contents of the Virginia plan when it was first introduced in late May of 1787, he would have gotten on his horse and rode to Philadelphia, been a member of the convention, and stood up and denounced it. But he didn't have a clue about what was going on until, I think it was September 22nd.
So in some respects, the people who didn't write the Constitution are just as important as those who did.
They are indeed.
That's remarkable.
And indeed, when you try to answer the broader question, who wrote the Constitution? Well, of course, the Constitution, once it was written in Philadelphia, had to be approved by the people of America at large in the ratification debates following, in every state following the drafting of the Constitution. And in that sense, the anti-federalists would have their say, but they were very much on the defensive from the get-go.
Absolutely. And that, of course, takes us back to Madison and the importance of his setting the agenda. We're talking with Professor Rick Beeman from the University of Pennsylvania about who wrote the Constitution. After the break, we'll be back with our constitutional quiz and then more fascinating discussion with Professor Beeman. Stay tuned.
It's a masterpiece, I say. They will cheer every word, every letter. I wish I felt that way. I believe I can put it better. Now then, attend as friend to friend, our Declaration Committee. For us, I see immortality in Philadelphia City.
Well, Doug Smith from James Madison's Montpelier, I sense that you have a quiz question for us today.
I'm feeling a little foul today, Stuart. A little foul.
A little foul? Why is that?
More like a bird foul. That's what my question's about.
A foul bird. Please go on.
Indeed. Well, we all know that the Great Seal of the United States has, of course, the bald eagle on it, right? But, you know, there were some other birds that we thought about putting on the Great Seal. And my question is whether your caller knows what other fowl were considered.
Well, I certainly don't know. So what are the choices?
Well, would you believe a rooster, A, is an option. B, a phoenix in the flames. Harry Potter would love that. C, a turkey. Or D, maybe your caller thinks it's all of the above.
And so people actually considered one or more of these others as an alternative to the eagle on the Great Seal of the United States.
It's the ultimate in group think.
Well, do we have a contestant on the line?
We do.
And who is our contestant?
My name is Micah from Pineville, West Virginia.
Micah. Well, Micah, did you hear the quiz guy?
I did.
Tremendous. Do you have any idea which of these four choices might be accurate?
I think I do. I'm pretty certain on what I think it is, but it could also be the all of the above.
All of the above?
No, I'm saying it could be that.
Okay.
My actual answer, I think, is the turkey.
The turkey, that's choice C. Why do you think a turkey was considered?
I remember reading that somewhere, and reading something about Benjamin Franklin, that he had suggested the turkey was a noble bird and prolific throughout America, and that it would be an appropriate seal.
Okay, but you don't remember anything about a rooster or about a phoenix?
Never heard of a rooster, never heard of a phoenix that I can remember, but I do remember reading about Benjamin Franklin saying that a turkey would be what he would suggest.
All right, well, quiz guy?
Well, you know, a lot of animals were contemplated, including a rattlesnake. But among the birds, in fact, the caller, Micah, you should have stayed with D, all of the above.
Oh.
It's true.
Are you kidding me?
A rooster, at one point, a phoenix in flames, you know, kind of rising above. And, I think Micah kind of wins this, because not only does he know about the turkey, but he correctly pegs. This is Ben Franklin's wacky ideas.
So the quiz guy is actually going to give a mulligan to Micah?
I'm gonna advocate for that. You know, the reality is that we went with the bald eagle because we thought it was majestic, but Franklin didn't like the bald eagle at all. He didn't like it because he said it was a bird of bad moral character. You know, sometimes it gets chased away by smaller birds, and it's come somewhat prone to carrion. It's fascinating the kinds of things that go into the thinking that create these brands of countries. And indeed, a turkey and a phoenix and a rooster were all in the running.
Well, Micah, the quiz guy is clearly a much easier grader than I am. And so if he says you get a T-shirt, well, then you get a T-shirt.
Oh, that's great.
Tremendous. Well, thanks very much for playing the constitutional quiz.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. You know, you can visit us on Facebook, and if you do, you can download a podcast. Isn't that cool? Today, we're talking about who wrote the Constitution, and we're talking with the guy who literally wrote the book, Professor Rick Beeman of the University of Pennsylvania. Let's talk about some of the other people there. Now, you've mentioned two other very familiar names. Could you comment on the, I'm talking of Franklin and Washington. Could you tell us about the contributions of George Washington to this convention, other than just showing up?
Okay. Washington was not the author of the Constitution, but he was the one indispensable delegate to the convention. It was the case that had Washington not been there, had he not only lent his prestige to the effort, but his leadership to the effort, we wouldn't have that Constitution today. On the first day of business of the convention, Washington was unanimously elected president of the convention. Now, the word president in 1787 didn't mean what we think of it today as the chief executive wielding wide powers. Rather, a president presided over either a legislative body or a deliberative body, and that is what Washington did. He presided over this convention. Who was it who called on Edmund Randolph at a key moment to introduce the Virginia Plan? It was George Washington. Who was it when the debate would get testy and when the delegates started to become uncivil toward one another? Who was it who would intervene and call on another more moderately minded delegate? It was George Washington who, although he gave only one relatively minor speech during the entire convention, it was Washington who presided, who made sure that these men of differing opinions and differing backgrounds actually managed to keep their eye on the ball and get the job done.
And when it was necessary, he woodshedded them. And there was one wonderful story that I had never heard before that I read for the first time in your book, and it had to do with secrecy. And as you point out, it was extraordinarily important to the passage of the Constitution, to its approval, that these deliberations be kept secret. And on one must have been terrifying occasion for the party involved, someone left his copy of a document that was outlining what was then going on in the Constitution, let it fall to the floor. And someone picked it up and handed it to Washington. There was this top secret document. And could you describe what Washington did when this was given to him?
So Washington, is again sitting in the front of the room on that raised dais and the chair with either the rising or setting sun on it, and he looks sternly out at the delegates, and he noted that someone had committed this indiscretion. of leaving a document which might betray the confidence of the convention. And he said, I shall leave it on my desk upon our adjournment, and will the gentleman who left it there please retrieve it and not make the same mistake again. And
then he stormed out of the room, didn't he?
He stormed out of the room, that's right.
Can you imagine? Yes. Can you imagine how the person must have felt? In fact,
that's right.
Anybody who even thought he had left something on the floor.
That's right. Well, one of the delegates who leaves this recollection was trembling with fear. He had been the one to leave it, and he quickly checked his sort of equivalent of his briefcase, and was greatly relieved to see that he was not the guilty party. We actually don't know who the guilty party was.
He never picked it up, did he?
No, he didn't. That's
so,
right.
So no one ever made claim to this document because he was so frightened, of incurring Washington's wrath.
Washington was a formidable presence, indeed.
Remarkable. What about Ben Franklin now? I think I know where you're going to go with this. He started out with his hospitality and conviviality. Was that his role?
Franklin's role in the convention is a peculiar one. He's 81 years old at the time. He is, along with Washington, one of the two legendary figures in the history of revolutionary America. In fact, both Franklin and Washington, you know, are widely known and widely esteemed in Europe as well. His presence at the convention is also very important. He's actually not as strongly committed to a strong central government as are most of his other Pennsylvania colleagues. But one thing he does do, as we've noted, is to provide hospitality and wit. On the other hand, Franklin's actual intellectual or rhetorical contributions to the convention are uneven, to put it charitably. He's given to standing up and making speeches that are really way off point, causing, I think, some of the delegates probably to roll their eyes heavenward. It does indeed seem to kind of slip in and out of senility. At one point, he proposes, this is a proposal I particularly like, Franklin's proposal for how we should appoint Supreme Court justices, that we should have a poll of every lawyer in the country, and let the lawyers of the country, this is what he called the Scotch method, let all of the lawyers in the country vote on who should be the Supreme Court justices. And Franklin's logic was is that the lawyers would vote for the best and ablest among them in order to get rid of their competition so that they could profit from the law cases that those lawyers would not be able to try. And then you'd end up with the best Supreme Court. I mean, we have enough trouble selecting and certainly confirming Supreme Court justices today, but the idea of having the lawyers of the country, who were quite numerous even in 1787, if not as numerous as they are today, the mind boggles. And so after a proposal like that, you know, the delegates would kind of grimace, and they'd say, oh, thank you very much, Dr. Franklin, and then they'd, you know, go on to some other subject.
Well, that's, you know, that's true. You know, Franklin was getting old, and sometimes people's minds do wander as they get older. But, you know, could you talk a little bit about Franklin's effect on the spirit of compromise?
Yes. Well, that is indeed. I mean, so that's the downside of Franklin's contribution. But truly, Franklin embodied the spirit of compromise. And on the closing day of the convention, September 17th, Franklin gives the last important and perhaps the finest speech of his life. He's too weakened by age and illness. He's suffering from gout and kidney stones, and he's near death to read the speech, so he has his colleague James Wilson read it for him. But in that speech, Franklin makes what to me is one of the most sagacious observations I've ever read, which is that whenever you gather together a group of men for their collective wisdom. And that's what we try to do, I think, men and women today, when we elect a Congress or a Senate or any other political body. You gather with those men all of their passions, their prejudices, their selfish and local interests, their difference in religious views, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, so from such a gathering, can a perfect production ever be expected? And the answer, of course, is no. But then he goes on to say that, but, you know, when I look at this Constitution, I find that I still have objections to some a part of it. But when I look at it, I'm surprised at how close to perfection it is. And he then went on to ask his fellow delegates, I certainly wish that the leaders and members of both political parties in our Congress today would heed these words. He asked him, would you please put aside for the moment your own sense of infallibility, and in spite of your objections to particular provisions of the document, to come forward and affix your signatures to it. And 39 of the 42 delegates present that day did come forward, and in that spirit of fallibility, and in spite of their objections to certain parts of the document, they signed it. So for me, Washington and Franklin, in different ways, showed qualities of leadership. Qualities of leadership that allowed a group of men as a collectivity to get the job done that is just so depressingly lacking in our Congress today.
Oh, yeah, in fact, I would...
Where in our Congress today
yeah.
Franklin or Washington?
Well, compromise is not a dirty word, and that, I think, was Franklin's message. In fact, it's an essential word. Unless you're going to resort to force, you've got to compromise with other people who disagree with you. That's the essence of our political system. And moreover, I'm kind of wondering, based on what you just said, if maybe Washington and Franklin don't deserve the moniker, the father of the Constitution, more than Madison did. Because, you know, Madison was an advocate for a certain viewpoint, the architect of it. But it was really Franklin and Washington who acted as the father of the convention together.
They were the elder statesmen of the convention.
They kept everybody else in line and kept them on task.
Right.
Well,
and again, my first answer to your question, who wrote the Constitution, was, well, the whole body did. And that is the case. And it was Franklin and Washington who, more than any other two, were the facilitators of that.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. You know, you can catch our podcast if you want to. Simply go to WETS.org, click on About, click on Podcast. Hey, and there it will be. Today, we're talking about who wrote the Constitution. And we're talking about that topic with Rick Beeman from the University of Pennsylvania.
Yes, you say.
And you say either.
You say neither.
And you say neither.
Either.
Either.
I neither.
A neither.
Let's call the whole thing off. Oh, yes. You like potato.
And you like potato.
You like tomato.
And you like tomato.
Potato.
Potato.
Tomato.
Tomato.
Let's call the whole.
Now let's talk some more to Dr. Rick Beeman of the University of Pennsylvania about who wrote the Constitution.
Yep. Well, who else was important now? We've talked about Washington and Franklin and Madison. We've mentioned a few other names, but who were the other primary?
I've got two others. Intellectually and in terms of force of personality and effectiveness of oratory, two candidates who come in a close second behind Madison in terms of intellectual contributions are James Wilson and Gouverneur Morris of Pennsylvania, two very different people.
And they're not household names these days.
Not household names at all.
Tell us who these guys were and what did they do?
James Wilson, in some respects, had a personality somewhat like Madison. Very scholarly. He was born in Scotland. He was educated at the University of St. Andrews. His father wanted him to become a minister, but he didn't. He ended up immigrating to America and becoming a lawyer. I think he was, along with Madison, the most intelligent person in the convention, the best educated, the most seriously intellectual. And James Wilson, more than any other delegate, although I think Madison shared this view, but Wilson articulated it most forcefully, really understood that if this new national or part national or part federal government was going to be truly effective, energetic would have been the word, and they used energy, the word energy a lot, then it had to be founded firmly on the will of we the people. Indeed, it is James Wilson who was the first convention delegate in various drafts of various parts of the Constitution who uses that phrase, we the people.
I just want to emphasize that this was not, today we take this as a given, you know, that sovereignty resides with the people, and that's where this all came from, and we're familiar with those first famous three words from the Constitution. But there was a huge debate that ran all throughout that summer between whether this government was going to be created by the states as entities or whether it was going to be created directly by the people.
That is exactly right.
And so he wanted the people to be the source of the power, not the states.
He did indeed. And the most interesting, at least interesting to me, aspect of this is that Wilson proposed early in the convention and proposed it again and again, but got shot down every time, to have direct popular election of the president. And he wanted direct popular election of the president because he understood that if the president, but this president was going to be, you know, the chief executive officer, not just a moderator of a legislature, if the president was going to truly have power, the president, one, needed to be independent of the legislature, and two, he needed to found that power on the will of we the people. Unfortunately, virtually no one in the convention ever supported Wilson's proposal for direct popular election.
Why would people object to the idea of having a direct popular election of the chief executive?
Well, a good question, of course. Why don't we do that today? Another
I was about to observe that if James Wilson had gotten his way, there would...
But in any case, the main reason, so some of the delegates, because these guys were not small D Democrats. They were small R Republicans. They believed in representative government. They believed that representatives, by and large, should be the best and the brightest and the most virtuous. So they were somewhat distrustful of the clamorous voice of the common man. So some of these delegates probably opposed Wilson's proposal because they thought that people were too stupid. But the far greater number of them opposed his proposal. And there was considerable justification for this, because they thought the people were too ignorant. How could a voter in Georgia know the qualifications of a candidate for the presidency in Massachusetts and vice versa? And the great enemy of progress in crafting this new government was not the stupidity of the people, was not fear of democracy, but the essential provincialism of the American people, a people widely, you know, spread out across a vast geographic space. And that really was the challenge that these folks faced. I mean, they'd faced it for years in the Confederation government. It was impossible to get the individual state legislatures, you know, to agree on what time of day it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the delegates, as much as they understood the theoretical merits of Wilson's proposal, were just afraid that, you could never produce a majority of popular votes for any single candidate, with one notable exception, which was Washington. I think everybody understood that if there was going to be a new government, and if there were going to be a president, the first president was going to be Washington. But after that, I think few had any confidence that the people would know enough to be able to come to a majority vote.
Okay, and so other than Wilson, who was the other fellow you mentioned that people might
Governor
not...
Governor Morris.
Governor Morris, now that's an interesting name.
Yeah, now Governor Morris, a very different personality than Madison or Wilson. Next to Washington, he is the tallest and most imposing man in the convention. In fact, he looked enough like Washington that he actually served as a model for several statues of Washington that were, erected in various states around the country. Morris outlived Washington by a number of years. Unlike Wilson and Madison, Morris was not so much a scholarly type as he was a highly sensual type. Whereas Madison and James Wilson were writing their bachelor's and master's essays at Princeton and St. Andrews on serious topics in political philosophy, Gouverneur Morris was writing his bachelor's and master's essays at Columbia University, King's College at the time, on wit, beauty, and love. And Morris's interest in those subjects was not purely cerebral. He, too, like Madison, was a bachelor at the time of the Constitutional Convention and would remain one for another decade. But he had a kind of scandalous extracurricular love life. The other notable fact about him was that in Philadelphia in 1780, just as his career was getting started, he was run over by a carriage and his ankle was badly broken. His regular physician was temporarily out of town, and a kind of substitute physician advised that they amputate his leg at the knee, which they did. So he walked for the rest of his life with a simple oak peg attached to his leg, a fact that did absolutely nothing to hinder his love life. And at one point, in fact, John Jay, who was a distinguished politician in New York who considered himself Gouverneur Morris's political mentor, John Jay wrote to a friend and said, "You know, sometimes I wish that Gouverneur had lost some other body part." because Morris's romantic indiscretions got him into a lot of trouble. But I fear I digress.
But that's all right. So what? In fact, I'd heard that it was the story was going around at the time that he'd actually lost a leg jumping out of a balcony to escape a returning husband.
That's right. Oh, I wish it were true. I wish it were true because it would be a great story. But people like to tell the story because, I mean, he inspired such stories. But alas, that was not true.
All right.
But let me, in all seriousness, say two other things about Morris. Gouverneur Morris. More than any person in the convention believed that this should be a supreme national government. And indeed, he introduced, immediately following the introduction of the Virginia Plan, he introduced a resolution into the convention that proposed that a supreme, a national government be created with a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. And that motion was tentatively passed at that time, although over the course of the convention, with the various compromises that were made, that became less clearly the case. But Morris, throughout the convention, basically said, "I don't care if the states continue to exist or not. You know, what good are they? Let's have a single consolidated national government." So he represented, along with Alexander Hamilton, the sort of extreme nationalist wing in the convention.
That's the first time you've mentioned Hamilton.
Hamilton doesn't deserve much mention.
Wait a minute. Didn't he write the Federalist Papers?
Well, there you go. Well, I'll tell you what, let me just finish
okay.
very quickly sum up Morris's chief contribution, and then I'll get to Hamilton.
Okay.
Gouverneur Morris was appointed chairman of what was called the Committee of Style, which was a committee appointed during the final week of the convention. And the job of the Committee of Style was to pull together the rough draft of the Constitution, which had been created about 6 weeks earlier by a committee called the Committee of Detail, which, by the way, James Wilson was most influential in, and that's why he had such an important hand in shaping the language of the Constitution. But Gouverneur Morris took the 23 articles in the original Committee of Detail report, edited them down, combined them into the 7 more artfully worded articles of our present Constitution. So it was a much more concise document, and indeed it remains the most concise, the shortest, written constitution on the planet Earth. And he also wrote the preamble. And it is in the preamble where the language from the Committee of Detail report gets changed to what we now have. The language of the Committee of Detail was, "We the people of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island and Providence plantations, even though they weren't there, Connecticut, New York, et cetera, do establish this Constitution." It was Gouverneur Morris who wrote that phrase, "We the people of the capital U, capital S, not small U, small S, United States," in order promote domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, et cetera, do ordain and establish.
Now, was that a significant change?
Well, as it turned out, that is the change which allows Abraham Lincoln in 1861 to say that this union is indissolvable, that this is not a union of we, the people of the states, but we, the people of the nation, the capital U, capital S, United States. And it was, and by the way, and Gouverneur Morris wrote those words with that, not with Lincoln explicitly in mind, but he intended that this government be conceived as a government of we, the people of the whole nation, of the United States. Now, I don't think that every single member of the convention shared that view. And certainly when the voters of America during the ratification debates voted on the Constitution, not all of them shared that view. But that was very plainly Morris's view from the get-go. So it's a monumentally important contribution. And as it turns out, that is the way we regard our government. Our government's authority is based not on the will of the states, but of the people of the United States.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Rick Beeman of the University of Pennsylvania. Wasn't he fantastic? Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our theme song is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. I'm Stuart Harris. And before I go, let me remind you, we're on iTunes. We're all over the internet. Listen to our podcasts. And also remember, you, not the next guy over there, but you are a part of the American experiment.